Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, July 20th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Hogan Park is for everyone. Officials, it's very important that Midlanders know Park's transformation is for entire community, not just sports teams. By Stuart Doreen. When Hogan Park is transformed, it won't be just for sports tourism. Officials with the project said this week, it is very important that Midlanders know that Hogan Park's transformation is for the entire community. We want this to be an asset for average Midlanders, said Laurie Blong, a member of the Conservancy overseeing the Hogan Park project, including those who live in that area. We want neighborhood kids walking over to play. We want parents taking their children. Blong said, there will be more to the Hogan Park project than sports parks, meant for tournaments or league play. The park, when completed, will likely get more use from its public spaces and common areas, including the dog park and splash pad. It is hoped that Hogan's transformation will do for regional parks in Midland, like Centennial Park did for congregating downtown. Park officials held a Quality of Place Conservancy event Tuesday night to show off the latest renderings. The Conservancy reported $36.5 million of the $55 million for the park's transformation has been raised. Larger donors include Pioneer Natural Resources and Diamondback Energy. Blong noted the design elements that are similar to other projects across Midland in recent years, including open-air concepts and shade structures. Renderings on display provided a glimpse at the entry area of the park, the Pioneer and Tall City pavilions, and the dog park. They have brought in elements that look like Midland, but still have a high level of quality design, Blong said. The pavilion spaces will provide opportunities for families and the community in general to hold events and gather, Blong said. And the park is connected to trails in the neighboring Sibley Nature Center and elsewhere in northeast Midland. Groundbreaking on the transformation is scheduled for the first quarter of 2023, Blong said, and during that time, park officials will talk with groups using the park. Blong said Conservancy Director Jamie Richardson is scheduled to meet with sports groups and general community members to gather input about processes and park programming. Jamie has been a benefit to the board and the volunteer group that has been working on this for years, Blong said. This article is entitled, Beto to Stop in Town Today. He brings his campaign event to Midland's MLK Community Center. By Stuart Doreen. Just days after the Texas Democratic Party convention and his campaign's announcement of a massive campaign fundraising haul, gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke is bringing the A Drive for Texas event to Midland. O'Rourke's Midland appearance is set to take place during an event which is scheduled from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. today at the MLK Community Center, 2300 Butternut Lane. A town hall is set for 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. The Midland stop is part of a 49-day, 5,600-mile tour of Texas. The Democratic candidate is challenging Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Midland County Democratic Party Chair Kathy Broderick said this week that the race between O'Rourke and Abbott has changed, not just because of the polls that are tighter, or last week's announcement that O'Rourke raised a $27.6 million from late February through June. She stated, Abbott, the incumbent, has, quote, nothing to run on, unquote. Abbott is responsible for making it easier to obtain and carry firearms, Broderick wrote in an email to the Reporter-Telegram. most Texans support common sense gun laws. Texans want reliable utilities. We are tired of Abbott's unreliable energy grid. Most Texans realize Operation Lone Star, Abbott's border security initiative, is a farce, and the funding should have been spent on schools or the grid. Broderick believes those attending Wednesday's event will see O'Rourke wants to be the governor for all of the people in Texas, not just Democrats. She said, O'Rourke will deliver a message about education for all teachers, parents, and children, and that he wants to fund schools and build a first-class education system. About border issues, Broderick wrote, having lived within 2 miles of the border, Beto understands immigration and border issues. While we need security, there also has to be compassion for those seeking asylum and requesting to immigrate to our country. Abbott's wall is not the answer. During O'Rourke's Senate campaign in 2018, he visited all 254 counties in the state, according to an article from the Texas Tribune. Beto will outline his plan to address issues that matter to Texans, Broderick wrote. He has traveled throughout this state and has listened to people. This campaign seems similar to 2018 with more efficiency, Broderick added. There is nothing more important than actually going into communities and talking to people about what is important to them. Midland County Republican Chair Sherry Merkitt stated that she doesn't believe O'Rourke's agenda, quote, is in line with how most Midlanders believe, unquote. Merkitt mentioned energy in particular. On O'Rourke's website under Energy and Environment, O'Rourke states he wants to add to our hundreds of thousands of oil and gas jobs by pursuing the Texas labor movement's aggressive clean energy jobs plan, which aims to create 1.1 million high-paying jobs over the next 25 years by investing in geothermal power generation, hydrogen-fueled energy, offshore wind, solar generation, energy efficiency, and more. And as energy consumers around the world increasingly demand cleaner energy, it's becoming clear that we will soon lose our leadership in oil and gas if we don't work seriously to remove emissions from the industry and better protect our air, water, and public lands. While Greg Abbott turns a blind eye when his wealthy corporate donors pollute, I will enforce our pollution laws and create jobs in emission reduction strategies like carbon capture and storage. Midland obviously is filled with oil and gas industry folks, and we are encouraged at our prospect of continuing to drill and be one of the top producers in the country. We have very little tolerance of an outsider wanting to come in and shut our economy down, Merkitt wrote. This article is entitled NWS, High Temps Range from 105 to 110, by Stuart Doreen. Midland went through another hot day on Tuesday, 105 degrees, which was tied for the hottest day of the summer, according to the National Weather Service. The 105-degree high temperature marked the 10th time that temperatures topped the 100-degree mark in Midland this month, and the 28th time in 2022. The NWS is calling for another hot day today, with a high temperature of 105 again expected at Midland International Airport. Temperatures are then expected to drop below 100 for the rest of the week. The typical high temperature for this time of year is 96 degrees, according to the NWS. As hot as it has felt to many in and around Midland, the temperatures haven't been as heated as the NWS is reporting to the east. The average high temperature in Midland this month, heading into Tuesday, had been 99.4 degrees. The average temperatures in Abilene and San Angelo had been 103.8 and 103.7 degrees, respectively. In Abilene, the high temperature reached 110 degrees for the second straight day. The NWS also reported that high temperatures have topped 100 degrees on 17 of 19 days this month and eclipsed 105 nine times. In San Angelo, the high reached 108 on Tuesday. The NWS also reported that high temperatures have topped 100 degrees on 17 of 19 days in July and eclipsed 105 on 10 different days this month. This article is entitled, Woman Dies After Shots Fired in Northwest Midland, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. A woman died as a result of a shooting Friday in Midland, according to the Midland Police Department. MPD reported Tuesday that officers responded Friday to a home in Midland regarding shots fired. TV station KWES has reported that location to be St. Andrew's Court, which is located between Midland Drive and Midkiff Road, adjacent to Trinity Park. MPD also reported that a male was transported to the hospital and released, and that the woman died at the scene. The shooter has not been identified, according to MPD. An autopsy by the Dallas County Medical Examiner was requested, MPD reported. The investigation is ongoing. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Gas Prices Fall to Two-Month Low, by Alex Longley, Bloomberg. U.S. retail gasoline prices fell below $4.50 a gallon for the first time since mid-May, starting to ease pressure at the pump for millions of Americans. The nationwide average was $4.495 a gallon, according to data released on Tuesday by the American Automobile Association. Prices have fallen more than 10% since hitting a record last month and are on a 35-day slide, the longest run of declines since April 2020. A run-up in gas prices this year has helped fan the fastest rate of inflation in decades, with U.S. consumer prices growing at 9.1% on a year earlier in June. President Joe Biden, under pressure to bring down costs at the pump, has just completed a trip to Saudi Arabia, in which he said he expects further oil supply increases. On Monday, Biden tweeted that oil and gas companies should be passing on lower costs to consumers, with headline crude prices slumping from their June peak. This article is entitled, Halliburton, Fracking Growth Almost Impossible, by David Weth, Bloomberg. Halliburton Company warned oil companies that don't have fracking equipment leased for new wells that they're probably out of luck, at least for the rest of this year. Supply chain snarls mean oil field service providers like Halliburton can't expand fracking fleets anytime soon, Chief Executive Officer Jeff Miller told analysts during a conference call Tuesday. The hitch may represent yet another blow to President Joe Biden's efforts to expand worldwide crude supplies and relieve some of the inflationary pressure on consumers. The oil field gear market is so tight that oil explorers already are talking to Halliburton about 2023 drilling and fracking schedules, well in advance of the typical planning cycle, he said. Even the diesel-powered fracking equipment that is being gradually supplanted by more climate-friendly electric equipment is scarce. Supply chain bottlenecks, even for diesel fleet, make it almost impossible to add incremental capacity this year, Miller said. Existing active equipment and experienced crews are in high demand and will continue to be highly sought after. This article is entitled, Report, Oil Trumps Renewable Power in Public Land Leasing, by Jennifer A. DeLuey, Bloomberg. Despite President Joe Biden's campaign vow to propel a clean energy revolution, the federal government continues to prioritize oil development over renewable projects on U.S. public lands, a new report finds. The analysis by the left-leaning Center for American Progress shows that In western states, significantly more public land is available for oil and gas leasing than for renewables development. That's true even in areas that are better suited for solar, wind, and geothermal projects than for drilling. A default position that gives fossil fuel development a leg up over cleaner energy sources, according to Jenny Roland Shea, deputy director of the center's public lands program. Pretty much everything is available for oil and gas leasing, and it's not that way for renewables, said Roland Shea, one of two report authors. More than 77% of renewable energy areas in the West are on lands with low oil and gas potential, though they remain open for oil and gas leasing, the analysis found. The contrast is particularly notable for public lands deemed highly favorable for geothermal energy. 83% of that territory has little oil, but is nevertheless available for drilling. The analysis underscores the tension in managing energy development on public lands that make up about a tenth of the U.S., particularly amid climate goals that will require vast more territory to play host to solar arrays and wind turbines. In a shift, the Interior Department last month scaled back available acreage in Biden's first onshore oil and gas lease sales. This article is entitled Oil Gains as Risk-On Sentiment Animates Listless Market by Julia Fanzeres and Devika Krishnakumar, Bloomberg. Oil rose for a second day following a rally in equity markets as thin liquidity left crude susceptible to broader moves. West Texas Intermediate rose 1.6%, recovering from intraday losses of almost 3% to settle above $104 a barrel. Broader markets continued to drive crude prices with liquidity limited since prices spiked following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Despite fluctuations in futures markets, crude barrels continue fetching huge premiums, suggesting tight supply. A disruption along the Keystone Pipeline cut shipments of some Canadian oil to U.S. refiners has exacerbated the tightness. Right now, liquidity is thin. People are away on holiday, there's more machines than humans, Amrita Sen, co-founder of consultant Energy Aspects Limited, said in a Bloomberg television interview. We can continue to trade in this very technical band, but structurally, this is a market defined by underinvestment. Oil markets have been volatile in recent weeks as traders navigated concerns that a looming recession would hurt demand and the fallout from a stronger dollar against the signs of tight physical supplies. Nearby Brent futures are trading in excess of $4 higher than the second month, a huge premium indicating that refiners are willing to pay up for barrels. Despite the strength in crude, refined product prices are starting to ease. U.S. nationwide gasoline prices fell to a two-month low, according to AAA data published Tuesday. In recent days, traders have been grappling with President Joe Biden's efforts to get Saudi Arabia to lift its oil production. On his visit to Saudi Arabia, Biden urged producers from the region to boost supplies. In response, Saudi ministers insisted policy decisions would be taken according to market logic and within the OPEC Plus coalition, referring to the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and allies, including Russia. The kingdom's foreign minister said there is no lack of oil on the market, but a lack of oil refining capacity to turn it into fuels. The whole concept of going to Saudi Arabia to ask for extra production is sort of impractical, Faridun Fesharaki, chairman of industry consultant FGE, told Bloomberg TV, noting that the kingdom has already been pumping crude at close to its historical peak, with relatively little spare capacity likely left to tap. If there's no buffer in the market, the prices will go haywire. This article is entitled, Oil Pipeline Outage Compounds Biden's Post-Saudi Crude Dilemma, by Robert Tuttle and Devika Krishnakumar, Bloomberg. Shipments of Canadian oil to U.S. refiners were thrown into disarray by a pipeline disruption just days after President Joe Biden's unsuccessful bid to coax more crude out of Saudi Arabia. The force majeure declared by TC Energy Corporation on some crude flows through its massive Keystone Pipeline prompted traders and refiners to bid up the price of a crucial grade of oil, potentially adding to already rampant energy inflation. The disruption triggered by a power outage at a pump station in South Dakota, where temperatures topped more than 100 degrees or 20 degrees above normal, came after Biden returned from a meeting with Saudi royalty without any pledges to expand crude supplies. The leader of the world's largest economy has been dogged for months by criticism of his handling of the worst inflation in decades and soaring prices for everything from gasoline to groceries. With U.S. midterm elections less than 4 months away, Biden has cast some of the blame on Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine and warned domestic consumers they may have to endure high pump prices for a while. In the refining and petrochemical region that hugs the U.S. Gulf Coast, the discount at which Canadian Cold Lake crude for August delivery trades to benchmark futures narrowed by more than 8% to $8 a barrel, according to Link Data Services. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, July 20th. Jesus Jesse Flores. Jesus Jesse Flores, 56, of Big Spring, died from a short battle with cancer. Jesse died peacefully in his home on July 15th. Jesse was born in Big Spring, May 26th, 1966, to Isabel and Jose Flores. Preceding his death will be his grandmother, Olivia M. Flores, grandfather, Longino Flores, daughter, Letty Molinar, and son, Alex Subia, as well as several uncles and aunts. He is survived by his wife, Yolanda Flores, mother and father, Jose and Isabel Flores, daughters, Jessica Flores, Amber Flores, and Sabrina Martinez, son, Chris Molinar, sisters, Anita Avila and husband, Roy, Olivia Ramirez and husband, Gus, Rosalinda Vieira and husband, Luz, Amy Flores and Mary Flores, brother, Joe Flores, as well as several grandchildren, numerous uncles, aunts, nieces, and nephews. Viewing is on Thursday, July 21st, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and the rosary from 7 to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. We will have a memorial tribute and mass to celebrate the life of Jesse Flores and Alex Subia. The date is later to be announced. Alan Keith Morgan. Alan Keith Morgan of Midland passed away on June 21st. A visitation will begin 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, July 21st at Nellie Pickle-Inwell's funeral home. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Friday, July 22nd at Mid-Cities Community Church. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Alan Morgan was born on September 12, 1957 in Midland, Texas, to Keith and Bervaline Morgan. He is survived by his loving wife, Giami Morgan, and daughter, Sydney Morgan, mother, Bervaline, and stepfather, Bobby New, mother-in-law, Yuzhen Zhang, and father-in-law, Guojing Shi, siblings, Galen and wife, Tricia Morgan, Gina and husband, Lanny Oppheim, Chris and wife, Charity Morgan, all of Midland, as well as many nieces, nephews, and cousins. Preceded in death is his father, Virgil Keith Morgan, grandparents Lester and Tulum Morgan, and Sidney and Bonnie Freeman. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle-Inwell Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Gary Wenkel. Gary G. Wenkel, 69, of Carlsbad, New Mexico, went home to Jesus July 11th. Gary was born on May 1st, 1953, in Michigan, North Dakota, to George E. Wenkel and Agnes M. Stropnicki Wenkel. Gary was preceded in death by his parents and grandparents, Survivors include his wife of 42 years, Denise, daughter Christine Mike Fugelston of Grand Forks, North Dakota, sons Ryan Crystal Wenkel of Carlsbad and Adam Wenkel of Carlsbad, as well as several grandchildren and numerous nieces, nephews, and friends. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, July 23rd at Calvary Assembly of God, 2107 West Church Street, Carlsbad, New Mexico. Condolences may be expressed at Denton Wood, DentonWood.com. James Milton Carver, Jr. James Milton Carver, Jr., 74, went to be with his Lord and Savior on July 17th. He was born on December 16th, 1947, in Weatherford, Oklahoma, to Milton and Peggy Carver. His family moved to Big Spring in 1951. Jim is survived by his wife, Carol Lee Carver, his daughter, Melissa Barlow, her husband, Kent, his son, Jeremy Carver, and daughter, Christina Wren, and her husband, Clint, as well as many grandchildren, uncles, aunts, and cousins. He is preceded in death by his father, James Milton Carver Sr., his mother, Peggy Louise Carver, his father-in-law, John Cecil Lambert, and mother-in-law, Ruth Lorene Lambert, brother-in-law, Ronald D. Lambert, and numerous aunts, uncles, and cousins. The visitation will be Thursday, July 21st, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. The celebration of life will be Friday, July 22nd at 2 p.m. at Wilshire Park Baptist Church. Graveside services will be held at Thornburg Cemetery in Kansas. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Mickey Ulis Taylor. Mickey Ulis Taylor, 79, of Midland, passed away on Friday, July 15th. The family will receive friends on Friday, July 22nd, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Saturday, July 23rd at 10 a.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Mickey was born on March 3, 1943, to Elaine and E.O. Taylor in Eastland, Texas. The family moved to Midland during the oil boom of the 1950s. Mickey is survived by his wife, Linda S. Taylor of Midland, stepson, Brant Barton, and wife, Shanna. He is also survived by his two sons with his first marriage, Mark Taylor and wife, Dana, as well as Daniel Taylor and wife, Cindy. He also had several grandchildren and numerous nieces and nephews. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Nancy Leota Martin. Nancy Leota Martin, 81, of Midland, passed away on July 16th. The family will receive friends on Tuesday, July 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Graveside services will be held on Wednesday, July 20th at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. Nancy was born on October 7, 1940, to Eloise and Leon Freeman in Oklahoma City. She is survived by her children, Barbara Armijo, Garland Butch Martin, and Heather Davis, as well as 8 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband, James R. Buddy Martin, and son, James R. Jimmy Martin. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. George Lamar Beecham. George Lamar Beecham of Odessa passed from this life on July 17th in Odessa. A funeral will be held on July 22nd at 10 a.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home, with burial immediately following at American Heritage Cemetery. Michael Heath McBride. Michael Heath McBride of Odessa died June 27th in Odessa. there are no services at this time. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, July 20th, 2022, front page. Warrants issued for game room employees. OPD seized more than $33,000 in cash from one location. By Kim Smith. Undercover Odessa police officers seized more than $33,000 from a local game room following an undercover operation last month, and the Ector County District Attorney's Office believes the owners should have to forfeit the money. Ector County District Court documents show an undercover detective went into the Maroon game room on Andrews Highway June 22nd, played a slot machine, received 5,790 credits, and was paid $55 by an employee. Detectives also observed two employees paying cash to other customers. Under Texas law, game rooms are not supposed to award customers prizes valued at more than $5. Court documents indicate the employee who gave the detective $55 has been seen carrying a bag filled with a large amount of money and been warned about the consequences of illegal gambling on numerous occasions in the past. On June 23rd, detectives executed a search warrant at the game room and seized $33,000, several ledgers with names and their cash payout amounts, and DVR systems, according to court documents. The detectives did not find any prizes that could be distributed to winning players. According to court documents, arrest warrants were issued to the two employees working on June 22nd, Ann Nguyen and Nu Pham. In addition, on Monday, the Ector County District Attorney's Office filed a notice of seizure and intended forfeiture for the $33,000 against game room owner Tone Nguyen and the employee who was working on June 23rd, Jinji Pineda. The DA's office alleges the money is contraband and subject to seizure and forfeiture under the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. As of Tuesday, no criminal charges have been brought by the Ector County District Attorney's Office as a result of the June operation. As of April, there were 26 game rooms operating within the city limits and 35 within unincorporated Ector County. In May, the Odessa City Council voted 5-1 to amend the game rooms ordinance, in part because Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths and OPD Chief Mike Gerke are convinced some game rooms are engaged in illegal gambling. The ordinance now limits the hours of operation, the number of game machines permitted, and the location of the game rooms themselves. According to court records, however, OPD officers were provided cash instead of credits during operations at a handful of game rooms in December 2019, March 2021, and May 2021. Those operations resulted in the seizure of more than $125,000. Small school choir champ. Professor says music brings out best in kids. Students in the fine arts are some of the nicest and most motivated people on their campuses, Frank Eichaner, associate professor at University of Texas Permian Basin, said. They also walk away with a really great chorale experience. Eichaner hosted the two-day small school choir camp Monday and Tuesday at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. About 65 students from Andrews, Monahans, Fort Stockton, Compass Academy Charter School, Brownfield, and Sweetwater participated. They get a chance to work with some of the finest directors in our area. They get to work with other students who are super motivated to do the same things that they love. Oftentimes, the students that want to audition for Allstate are some of the best singers and most committed people in their program, he added. Eichaner said many of these students would call themselves choir kids because it's their primary activity. At the camp, they can meet other like-minded students. It really helps them. Many of these kids will go on to sing in college, and they'll earn college scholarships because they have a unique skill set that is really valuable, Eichaner said. He added that the process of making music together makes them better people. It sounds trite, but kids that are in choir, band, and orchestra are not picking up handguns. Making the social connections is powerful, Eichaner said. Making music with people who often have different perspectives helps students develop empathy. It helps them develop compassion. It helps them develop really powerful ways to deal with the emotional challenges that we all experience, Eichaner said. Making music helps them give voice to those feelings in a positive and proactive way, as opposed to, you know, it building up until, you know, there's a crisis of some kind. These people are some of the nicest, kindest, other-focused kids in their school because that's what the arts bring. It makes them better people by virtue of making beautiful music together in an environment with other people, Eichaner said. The small school's camp is just 2 days and usually has 75 to 80 students. Normally, we have a contingency from Big Spring, but they weren't able to come this year. Our usual number for this camp is about 75 to 80. But again, like the other camps, we have not totally recovered from COVID, Eichaner said. A lot of the same methods are used with the large and small school campus. Many of the techniques are going to be the same because, as they say, the fundamentals don't change. We're teaching great posture. We're teaching great breathing techniques. We're teaching the students how to use their voices to sing beautifully in every register. We're teaching them how to sight read well. We're teaching them how to be musical. We are teaching them how to interpret texts. Those are going to be the same whether I'm teaching a sixth grader or a college student, Eichaner said. What does change is the music. Of course, the small school repertoire is different music. It's designed for a different constituency of students who have a different skill set, so it doesn't tend to have as extreme of ranges. It tends to be less divisi, split into parts. Because the students that go through our small school programs, they don't sing that complex of a repertoire. It's the same principle. We don't ask our 3 and 4A high school football teams to play the 6A teams, because when you take the best players in a school of 400, you're obviously going to have a different product than if you take the best 12 players from a school of 4,000. The music is designed to help them be really successful. It's challenging for them, but it's a different challenge than it would be for the large school choirs, Eichaner said. He added that they were fortunate to have found some incredible section leaders. Mr. Michael Matlock is the head director at Andrews. He's leading our tenors. Gabriel Sanchez, who is a UTPD graduate, he's the assistant director at the high school at Andrews. He's leading our bass sectional. Ms. Billy Lou Billett is assistant in Monahan's. Our soprano section leader is Ms. Whitney Ellison. She is actually at the middle school in Andrews, but she's just a straight-up fantastic teacher, Eichaner said. Each section has a couple of UTPB upper division students who are sitting in, singing, helping, and coaching individual students. We add additional value to the camp by asking a couple of our vocal faculty, Dr. Rochelle Woolston and Mr. David Corman, to pull the students out throughout the week to teach individual lessons so that the kids get a chance to get some in-depth study in their own voice. It's very helpful for them, Eichaner said. Mary Jane Cargyle, the middle and high school choir director at Brownfield, is in her 5th year at school and her 3rd year coming to camp. I am rebuilding the choir program, and so it has helped me a lot. When I came, there were very few kids in choir. We're up to about 150 now between both campuses, so it has built the excitement and musicality for the students, Cargyle said. I think the easiest way to put it is when you're in a small school and you don't see other people singing as much when you come to something like this, it gives you a vision for what could be, she added. She brought 6 students Tuesday. She added that the camp is a long way from Brownfield, but it's worth the trip. There are camps that are closer, but I find this one more personable. Dr. Eichaner is just fabulous. He interacts with the students so well, Cargill said. It is a smaller campus than Texas Tech, for example, but the quality of instruction is fabulous, she added. The students also get to meet other peers from smaller schools. Omar Guerrero, head choir director at Fort Stockton Middle and High School, said there are about 50 in the high school program and about 80 in middle school. As a new teacher, Guerrero said the camp has been great for him because he's able to see how other teachers from around the area ply their craft. I've been going in and out of different sessions of different sections, tenors, basses, altos, sopranos. They are all very effective in the way that they teach, and my students are getting to sing with other singers that love to sing just as much as they do, Guerrero said. He added that this is the first time that some of his students have been able to attend camp because of COVID. Guerrero said that he can already tell the camp is helping his students. The kids that decide to come are usually the ones that are at the top of my choir. They're the best singers in the choir. And now they get to be around other singers, other great singers, a little more competition. Hopefully, their all-region auditions will go well. But at least this will make them work a little harder, knowing that there's other singers out there just as good as them, if not better, Guerrero said. Deja Dominguez, a 16-year-old Fort Stockton junior, said this is the first time she has attended one of the camps. Dominguez said it was cool because when she did all region before, she had to learn music on her own, so this is helping her learn the music. She added that she likes being around students who are just as good as she is. Dominguez said the experience will make her feel more confident when she auditions during the quest for state. Karima Garcia Johnson, a 16-year-old from Monahans High School, Ave McGill, a 15-year-old from Andrews High School, and Kristen Allen, 17, from Sweetwater High School, are all glad they were part of the camp. I think it takes something hard and abnormal that we do and makes us more competent to go in front of a judge, Allen said. Friends and family remember Pam Price. Surrounded by her works of art, friends, colleagues, and loved ones of the late Pam Price gathered for a celebration of her life Tuesday in the Nancy Fife Cordozier Gallery on the University of Texas Permian Basin campus. Price, an artist, educator, visionary, and advocate, died May 22nd at her home in Odessa. She was 77. Her career was spent at UTPB. Those who spoke at the celebration described her as a storyteller, avid bridge player, talked about the way she swore in class, knew her own mind, enjoyed life, had tremendous attention to detail, and had fun with her art. She was also described as a brilliant administrator and ferocious supporter of the art department. Price was born in San Francisco on June 9, 1944, the first of three children, while her dad was stationed there after Pearl Harbor. The family later lived in South Carolina, Ohio, and Georgia, information from the celebration said. Price majored in printmaking, painting, and drawing at Georgia State University, where she earned her Bachelor of Arts and a Master of Fine Arts in Printmaking from the University of Georgia. She married Joel Roderick Rod Price in Decatur, Georgia, July 18, 1970. The couple moved right away to Washington State and stayed there while Rod worked on his law degree, later moving to Lubbock, where he graduated. The Prices then moved to Odessa, where Rod joined a law firm and started his career. By 1974, Pam had taken a position teaching art at UTPB. She would later become the head of the art department and dean of humanities, the information said. Her tenacity resulted in the expansion of art at UTPB. She won many awards. Those who spoke also said she was a force in making UTPB a four-year school. Those left to cherish her memory are her brother Wayne and his wife Carolyn Finney Champion, her brother, Stephen's wife Deborah Powell Champion, Aunt Patricia Laughter, and Uncle Randall Champion, nieces and nephews, great-nieces and great-nephews. Price was preceded in death by her husband, Rod Price, parents John Clyde and Lorraine Weber Champion, and her brother, Stephen Champion. Associate Professor of Art Chris Stanley said Price retired after 35 years of service to UTPB as a full professor. She was quickly awarded emeritus status, which meant that she had rights and privileges to come back anytime she wanted. And we shortly brought her back. She led us through a very, very difficult period of time, particularly during the reaccreditation process when we needed her surgical vision, Stanley said. He added that Price was a fierce advocate for women in the arts and a force in moving UTPB to a four-year university. During her tenure, Stanley said Price oversaw nearly every critical phase of the creation of the art major. She also hired Stanley and several others to work at UTPB. The Pam Price Endowed Art Scholarship has been established in her name. Stanley said it is now up to $55,000, thanks to an anonymous donation received Tuesday. Price's estate also gave $10,000. Former UTPB President David Watts, who attended the gathering, said he knew Price the whole time he was at UTPB. Her work is on display at the Nancy Fife Cardozier Gallery. Anything I would say would just duplicate what's already been said. She was a great faculty member, great teacher, visionary leader, and, as you can see, an incredible artist, so her passing is a loss, but she left a great legacy, Watt said. Associate Professor of Art, Chairman of the Department of Arts, Mario Kieran, said he started at UTPB in the fall of 2009, hired by Price. She and I became pretty good friends. She advised me on a lot of stuff. When I got stuck with something, especially the administrative part of it, I visit with her, talk to her, and she would give me advice. She would say, okay, so these are the things you need to do. These are the things that might happen, and these are the things you're going to do in order to move things forward, Karen said. In lieu of flowers, people may donate to the Pam Price Endowed Art Scholarship, www.utpb.edu, or make a tax-deductible contribution to the Office of Institutional Advancement, UTPB, 4901 East University Boulevard, Odessa, Texas, 79762. Quick hits. What We Believe event. Odessa First Assembly, 1101 North Lee Avenue, has scheduled Belief, What We Believe, at 7 p.m. today, Wednesday. Visit tinyurl.com/UB2ZVMTK. After School Program Registrations. The Boys and Girls Club of Odessa, Headley Unite, 1476 North Knox Avenue, is currently accepting registration for after-school program for ages 6 and older through Friday. Spots are limited. The program will include a hot meal, homework help, art, computer room, movie room, gym activities, connect room, game room, field trips, and more. Drop-off only fee is $80 per kid. To register, call 432-337-8389 or visit basinkids.org. School Supply Drive. The Odessa East Rotary Club has scheduled a school supply drive through July 29th. Drop items off at the Abalos Law Office, 520 North Lee Avenue. The drive will benefit ECISD students. ECISD hosts Leadership University. Ector County ISD leaders will spend the next couple of days learning from each other and guest speakers, including the Texas Commissioner of Education. ECISD's annual Leadership University runs through Thursday at Crossroads Fellowship, 6901 East State Highway 191. This year's theme is Level Up and includes nearly 50 breakout sessions, group learning time, two keynote speakers, and a community panel of local leaders offering insight on a variety of leadership topics. ECISD's Leadership University began at 8:30 a.m. Tuesday with a presentation from Superintendent of Schools Scott Murray. After the first round of breakout sessions, the first keynote comes from Pete Gorman, President and Chief Executive Officer of Peter Gorman Leadership Associates, LLC, who has been recognized nationally as an education leader and for developing outstanding leadership teams with more than 30 years of experience in education and business. Wednesday morning starts at 8:30 a.m. with video session from Education Commissioner Mike Morath, the panel discussion with Odessa College President Dr. Gregory Williams, University of Texas Permian Basin President Dr. Sandra Woodley, Education Partnership of the Permian Basin Director Dr. Adrian Vega, and Odessa Chamber of Commerce President CEO Renee Earls. Leadership University is a project of ECISD's Development Department and aligns with the district's strategic plan to grow strong leaders by providing meaningful professional development opportunities that help level up their leadership skills. Classes enrolling now at PBALC. Permian Basin Adult Literacy Center is currently enrolling for fall 2022 English classes. Classes will begin on August 1st and late enrollment will end on August 18th. Through a new partnership with Hearts for Health's Student Refugee Mentor Initiative, PBALC will offer English language learners the opportunity to work one-on-one with an SRMI tutor or participate in an SRMI tutor lead conversation group. The tutoring opportunity is only available virtually. Participating students will be required to complete 2 to 3 hours of virtual class time with their tutor each week. Students do not need to live in the Permian Basin to apply. Contact PBALC before August 7th to be considered for this virtual tutoring opportunity. Students are encouraged to contact PBALC's office at 432-682-9693 to schedule their enrollment appointment. Student applications can be completed on PBALC's website at https://bit.ly/PBALC student. Classes and tutoring are open to adults 18 years of age and older. Students are required to pay a semester enrollment fee of $25. For more information, email PBALC Program Coordinator Andrea DeYoung at adeyoung@pbalc.org. We Are the World is Summer Day Camp. Summer can present challenges for families who wish to provide their special needs children with the same summer camp other children enjoy. This is changing thanks to a special camp in the Permian Basin. We Are the World, WATW, in collaboration with Bynum School Midland Children's Rehabilitation Center, MCRC, and Spectrum of Solutions, formerly MARC, provide summer day camps for special needs children and their siblings, a news release said. At WATW, our children are genuinely included in everything and appreciated for their strengths and abilities, WATW Director Ton Zachary said in the release. Participants benefit from low staff-to-student ratios, highly qualified staff, and an inclusive, welcoming environment. Families can take advantage of WATW for 3 weeks during the summer and 2 days during academic breaks at no charge. The camp's inclusive environment promotes peer interaction, fosters growth, and reinforces concepts taught in the classroom. WATW Camp allows kids to have fun, participate in enjoyable activities, and interact with other children their age, Bynum School Executive Director Carrie St. John said in the release. When children with special needs have opportunities to play and learn with others who share similar life experiences, they begin to view their disability as a unique, positive, and integral part of themselves. Over the past 4 years, we have grown from 60 to 350 campers, Zachary said in the release. For parents, finding an inclusive environment that supports their child's unique needs requires some searching. When camp isn't tailored to the needs of children, it can be overpowering. In addition, parents appreciate the chance to send their children to a camp where they can be independent, safe, and productive. It is difficult to describe how good they are to my daughter and how accommodating and careful they are to ensure she is included. They are the best people, said parent Bailey Beasley. Council hears pleas for higher fire rescue pay by Kim Smith. After listening to members of Odessa Fire Rescue for 2 hours Tuesday, the Odessa City Council informally agreed that it wants to go ahead and hire an independent company to analyze every city department's compensation packets, but will ask the company to expedite its analysis of OFR and the Odessa Police Department. The entire analysis is expected to wrap up by the end of the year, but the council is hoping to have the expedited study done within 2 months. Last year, OFR lost 35 employees, most of whom headed to other departments for higher pay. Another 22 have left so far this year. More than half a dozen OFR stood before the council, expressing their dismay that city staff was asking the council to spend $111,000 for a study that won't be completed until the end of the year. According to those who spoke, most of those leaving the department are leaving as soon as they obtain certifications that make them attractive to other departments, and it's usually within 5 years of their hire date. Speaking in front of a room packed with off-duty OFR personnel, OFR engineer Austin Schaefer pointed out the city had a similar study performed 3 years ago and questioned the need for a new study. Firefighter paramedic Josh Heron pointed out that study shouldn't be relied upon because firefighters are no longer just leaving for Midland and Lubbock, which were included in the study, but they're leaving for the Metroplex and even Pecos, which recently formed its own fire district. In addition, Heron noted that many of the cities included in the 2019 study do not go on medical calls, whereas 75 to 80% of Odessa's calls are EMS calls. The firefighters provided the council with a document comparing the various departments that OFR firefighters have joined recently and OFR. They compared the number of calls, the number of stations, population, salary comparison, and the number of steps before pay tops out. Odessa is the busiest fire department in the state per capita, with 21,000 medical and fire calls a year, and a starting firefighter earns just under $54,000 a year. However, a starting firefighter in Mansfield earns $68,000 a year, and they only respond to 5,000 calls a year. Zach Webster, another OFR engineer, said 55% of OFR staff has less than 5 years' experience, and many of them aren't paramedics. They're EMTs. By the time they reach their 5-year mark and have become paramedics and receive some other certifications, your average firefighter paramedic can go anywhere, and when they leave because of higher pay, Webster said. Captain Tyler Hochin, a 17-year OFR veteran, said something needs to be done now to address the retention issue. Our first responders are leaving in droves because they're learning their worth in other places. We've got to show them their worth here, Hochin said. The firefighters noted that while they can earn additional money with each certification they obtain and That incentive pay is attractive. It takes time to take those classes, time they'd rather spend with their families. In addition, they have to pay for those classes out of their own pocket. The problem, they say, is the base pay. In addition, they noted that the city has a very generous pension and health insurance benefits, but young firefighters aren't thinking about those things a few years into their career when they're struggling to put food on the table. The firefighters also mentioned that it only takes 12 years for firefighters in other cities to max out on salaries, and yet it takes 20 years in Odessa. The firefighters also pointed out to the council that eventually the city's insurance services office score will begin to suffer, which will drive insurance rates up and deter large businesses from locating in Odessa. Again and again, the firefighters said, they love Odessa and they want to raise their children in Odessa. Many of those firefighters who have left have said in their exit interviews they wish they could take the department with them because they loved their jobs, but felt they had no choice, Heron said. We didn't sign up to be at the station 48 hours watching cartoons. We want to be making calls, making a difference, Heron said. He left OFR in October 2019 to go to another department and came back because he loves Odessa. During his 9 months away, he went to one fire call. In Odessa, in one 26-hour period, I fought 5 residential house fires. That's what we signed up to do. That's what sets us apart from all these other cities, and that's why we're saying we cannot be compared to the normal 6 communities OFR is normally compared to. Nor can OFR be compared to the Metroplex, he said. I promise you they don't do what they do, and the guys want that, but they also want to provide for their families and have a home life and watch their kids grow up, Heron said. The council is expected to formally hire Evergreen Solutions at its meeting next Tuesday. In addition to asking the company to expedite the process for public safety officers, they'll also be asked to meet with OFR union members. Mayor Javier Hoven thanked the firefighters for their attendance. Work with us. We're definitely going to work with you. We heard you. We agree with you. And let's continue this open dialogue if it's possible. I just want everyone to walk away not believing that we weren't heard, that there were deaf ears, and that we were just not going to listen, and that we were just going to skip ahead with whatever plan we have, Hoven said. Let's just take it one step at a time. Obituaries and death notices, published July 20th. John Paul Carrion Reyes, Odessa. John Paul Carrion Reyes passed away July 11th at Midland Memorial Hospital. He was born and raised in Odessa on August 27th, 1984, to Elfelda Lid and Carlos Reyes. He is preceded in death by Maria Farr, aunt, Honorado Carrion, uncle, Juliet Petruzzi, aunt. He is survived by his 2 daughters, Janice Nicole Reyes, 23, Jocelyn Victoria Reyes, 9. The mother of his children, Esther Marie Molinar, 38. His parents, Lid, 65, and Carlos, 65, and his brothers, Justin, 36, Joshua, 30, Jeremy, 25, and several aunts, uncles, cousins, multiple godchildren, 1 niece, and 1 nephew. A vigil was held at Sunset Memorial Tuesday, July 19th, followed by Rosary. Funeral Mass will be Wednesday, July 20th at 11 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church, 612 East 18th Street, Odessa, 79761. If you would like to join the bike rally, please arrive at sunset at 9 a.m. Wednesday, July 20th, 2022. In lieu of flowers and gifts, the family requests memorial tributes in John Paul's honor to be directed to St. Mary's Catholic Church in Odessa for the continued growth and creation of the new columbarium at St. Mary's. George Lamar Bo Beecham, Odessa. George Lamar Bo Beecham, 83, died unexpectedly in his home July 17th. He was born February 3rd, 1939, in a log cabin in Sabinetown, Texas, the son of George Lamar and Pearl Elizabeth Anderson Beecham. In addition to his parents, he is predeceased by his son, Gilbert Wayne Beecham. Grandchildren, Russell Hohen, Melissa Hohen, Adam Hohen, and Nico Hosey. Surviving, in addition to his wife, Martha Ann Epps Beecham, are his children, Brenda and her husband, Brian Hohen, Greg and his wife, Nancy Beecham, Brandy and her husband, Luke Wallace, as well as three grandchildren that they raised. They also have 14 more grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. One sister, Marie McBride and her family, brother Charles and wife Suzanne and their family, and brother Alvin and wife Jean and their family. A service of remembrance will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 22nd at American Heritage Funeral Home, 4100 North FM 1788, Midland. David Gomez Souza, Odessa. David Gomez Souza, age 71, passed away at Lamon Lusk Texas State Veterans Home in Big Spring, Sunday, July 17th. He was born in San Juan, Texas, Tuesday, July 10th, 1951, to Rosendo and Teresa Gomez Souza. Those left to cherish his love and memory are his significant other, Jan Davis, son, Neil Riggin, and wife, Tessa of Odessa, daughter-in-law, April Riggin, brothers, Edward Souza and wife, Amelia of Monahans, Rudy Souza of Dallas, sisters, Becky Harper of Panama, Teresa Souza of Odessa, and Rosalinda Souza of Alamogordo, New Mexico. Numerous children, grandchildren, nieces. He's preceded in death by his parents, his son Jeffrey Ben Riggin, brothers Amador Souza, Robert Souza, and Joe Souza, and his sister Adela Souza. Visitation at the funeral home is Thursday, July 21st from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Funeral services will be at Acres West Chapel Funeral Chapel Friday, July 22nd at 2 p.m. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West, and condolences may be sent to the family online at acreswestfuneral.com. Death notice for Wednesday. Edward John Snook, Odessa. Edward John Snook of Odessa died Friday, July 15th in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Odessa Funeral Home, 7511 of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.